This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Emma Dunphy. Now, the war in Ukraine has entered its second year. It's Putin's war. It went wrong from the very first moment of the invasion of Ukraine, and it has gone wrong in many ways for what Putin calls his special military operation. And we have been fortunate enough to talk to Johnny O'Reilly, a journalist and filmmaker, throughout this conflict, and he's been extremely helpful to us and to our listeners, telling us what's really happening. He's written a piece now for The Currency. The Currency is an online publisher. It's a brilliant operation, and Johnny has written a really outstanding piece of print journalism for the latest edition of The Currency, and he joins us now from Kyiv. Johnny, thank you very much. I know you're making a film and a documentary as well as doing your stuff for us and for The Currency. Your description of what's really happening and the difference between the Russian army or troops and the Ukrainians is really extraordinary. And I want to talk to you first about the first thing that went wrong. Putin's plan, as most people understand it now, was that they could take Kyiv, where you're talking to us from, in days. They could put a puppet regime in place and the job would be done. They screwed that up by leaving all their tanks in a straight line in a traffic jam. Can you explain exactly what happened?
Well,
for The Currency, so we just want to hear it from your own lips.
Well, they almost did take Kyiv, actually, but their original plans were so full of holes that there were many points at which the plan was going to fail. I'm sure military historians will have plenty to write about this, you know, now and in the future. But we may all remember that 40-mile-long tank column that was coming from Belarus in the north, and how ominous that all felt. Essentially, what had happened was that Putin had kept his own middle-level commanders unaware of his own plans until the very last minute. And to plan something on that scale, you need to organize everything from fuel, food, clothing, as well as ensure that all your troops and your commanders of smaller units know exactly what to do. So they started that whole column without sufficient planning.
Yeah, and they called it the invasion. They refused to call it an invasion or a war, a special military operation.
Yeah, it was a special military operation because Putin did not want to alarm people at home with the true scale of what he was planning. With the assumption that it would be over very quickly.
Yeah.
But what happened was they underestimated the Ukrainians on the one hand. They didn't properly put into their plans the ability of the Ukrainians to use and to deploy this relatively new technology that the British in particular, but also the Americans had supplied, these handheld NLAWs and javelins. And what happens when you've got a large column of tanks, you know, coming your way, and you have a nimble army that can, under the cover of forest, attack those, that column is, you attack the first few tanks and then the back tank, then the tanks at the back. And you essentially create a kind of a traffic jam. And because it was March, it was kind of late February, the ground at the time was quite soggy. It wasn't as hard as the Russians were unlucky with the weather back then. It wasn't as cold as it normally would be in February. So the tanks and the armored vehicles could not circumnavigate, go into the fields. They had to stay on the roads, and they essentially got stuck in a very large traffic jam. I mean, partly due to a lack of fuel, lack of planning, and too many smaller groups not communicating with each other. So they essentially became sitting ducks for the Ukrainians, who under the cover of forest were able to, first of all, attack the front and the rear of those columns. And then thereafter, you know, destroy many of them with artillery. So it was a big success for the Ukrainians. And it was something which was replicated in other parts of the war as well. The Russian army demonstrated that they did not learn and are continuing to demonstrate that they are not learning from their mistakes.
Yeah, the problem, as you've outlined, it appears to be that the decisions are being made in Moscow, in the Kremlin, by Putin and his generals or cronies, and then they're being handed down to the troops who are actually fighting in the field. The Ukrainians, on the other hand, have their best military brains in the field who can make decisions as events unfold. Is that, in a nutshell, Putin's biggest problem?
That is Putin's biggest problem. I mean, it is an important military doctrine of NATO to decentralize decision-making, because commanders on the ground always know better about what decisions to make. So for the last 8 years, Ukraine has been trained by NATO, and Ukrainian commanders have been learning the NATO doctrines. Now, there still is the legacy of the Soviet military system within the Ukrainian military, but they're further ahead down the road of decentralization than the Russians are. So that means that decisions in on the Ukrainian side take more into account the conditions on the ground, while in the Russian side, decisions are more political, if you like. They're less focused on what is what is happening on the ground. And therein lies the disparity in success between the two sides, and also the political requirements of Russia seems to be driving many of the decision-making of the Russian army, particularly, obviously, the first decision of all to actually invade the country. So what the Ukrainians and the Russians, to some extent, have been doing is the natural process of improving as you go along, learning from some of your mistakes. But the Russians are still committing the same mistakes that they made over a year ago. And that's mostly due to the political requirements of Putin himself to secure short-term progress at all costs.
Now, there's a very interesting story you tell about the airport at Kherson, which is a city that Russia took but Ukraine have subsequently retaken it. But there's an airport there, Kherson International Airport. It's difficult for me to try and pronounce it, but I will.
Chernobyevka.
Okay, Chernobyevka. Now, the Russians rolled in and they captured Chernobyevka in the first week of the war, but they failed to push the Ukrainian army beyond artillery range. Now, tell us what happened then, because it's a really good example of incompetence, as you point out in your piece, and as I stress, it is really excellent, and the currency are lucky to have you.
Well, thanks for that. Airports and aerodromes are the most important supply locations for the war. They're the most coveted installations by both sides. So the airport at Chernobyevka, which incidentally were in talks with Ryanair before the war to have Ryanair flights there. So it covers much of the south of Ukraine. The next airport over on the west of that is Odessa. But Chernobyevka was a hugely important supply route for the Russian southern offensive, which ultimately was trying to take Odessa. So along that southern coast, they took Kherson very quickly and moved very quickly towards Odessa, but got stuck just outside a city called Mykolaiv, halfway between Kherson and Odessa. And they did take the airport, but only about 15 to 20 kilometers from the front line. So that meant that the airport was within range of Ukrainian artillery.
They used the airport as a helicopter base.
Yeah, they brought in dozens of helicopters. They very quickly mobilized as much as they could in order to, as quickly as possible, push forward to take Mykolaiv and ultimately Odessa. But they never got further than 20 kilometers beyond Chernobyevka. So that meant that the airport was always under Ukrainian fire, artillery fire. And they would have been, focused on that as the most important installation that the Russians controlled. But I remember as early as the 12th time the Chernobyevka was attacked by Ukrainian artillery, and new recruits and Russian technical equipment was destroyed. It became a meme in the Ukrainian media that Chernobyevka was a bit like Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
Every few days, the Russians would bring in more equipment, more personnel, and they would just be like sitting ducks, destroyed by the Ukrainian artillery. And ultimately, 30 attacks, successful attacks on the city, on the town, destroyed 30 waves of Russian Russian personnel and equipment. So it kind of speaks to the political requirements to, at all costs,
yes,
take that southern offensive, improve that southern flank. Despite the obvious dangers, they kept on repeating the same mistake.
Yes, and they're playing to a gallery at home. Putin has to play to that gallery. Ukraine is actually fighting the war cleverly, using its own wits and whatever else it has in the way of munitions and weaponry. Now, as you say, the airport story became a kind of a method of describing the incompetence of the Russians. The other interesting thing is the description in your piece about the Wagner Group, which is a now notorious militia. Prigozhin is their leader. He himself is a former prisoner, but the group appears to be made up of conscripts, people let out of prison if they'll fight. And then they have an elite force, but they send the conscripts and the prisoners in first, and they're just cannon fodder.
Yeah, that's right. Bizarre to imagine in this day and age that this is the way war is waged, you know, very similar to, you'd imagine the way war was waged in feudalistic times. But, you know, it speaks to the modern day feudalism of the Russian state that you have 10,000 highly trained Wagner contract employees.
Yes.
And 40,000 convicts who have been released from Russian prison with the promise of clemency if they can fulfill a six-month contract in Ukraine. Unfortunately, for many of them, they don't fulfill that 6 months because they either die or get injured on the ground. The Wagner Group have been leading the charge in Bakhmut for the last 4 months. They've made very slow progress, but more progress than the main Russian army has in other places. So Prigozhin is trying to use the small progress that they've had to gain privileges for his group within the army and also to kind of augment his political position at home. But essentially, they operate a system of cannon fodder where these convicts are taken out of prisons. They are moved to the front line by train, heavily guarded, and pushed onto the battlefield and told if they retreat, they will be shot. So many of the conflicts who have been taken as prisoners of war, for example, by the Ukrainian side, have these terrible stories of you know, being in the middle of the shooting range, both on the one side from the Ukrainians, the other side from the Russian commanders behind them. They've been dying at a higher rate than any other group within the war.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Now, this conversation we're having, Johnny, about what you've seen and written for The Currency, the context really is the resumption of the all-out war as it is in the late spring, you say, which would be in the not-too-distant future. Bakhmut has assumed this incredible importance. And again, you write about this in the piece. And it's ridiculous, really, isn't it? Because it has no great strategic importance.
It has no strategic importance other than the amount of personnel that are being killed there. From the Ukrainian point of view, they have been operating a defensive war quite cleverly by enticing Russian troops to areas that they know is of strategically less importance than others,
yes,
and fighting them in these zones, knowing that whenever you attack a position, in order for the attack to be successful, you generally need about a 3-to-1 ratio of personnel. And under those circumstances, there's always going to be a higher casualty rate on the with the attacking force than the defending force. So, like, one thing to consider about the war as a whole is something that I've kind of learned, which has surprised me a bit, but makes sense, that it's there's a big difference between, you know, force positioning when you're attacking and force positioning when you're defending.
Yeah.
It's not something that you can just switch overnight. You need to mobilize all of the different positions and equipment for defense as opposed to attack. So it's almost like a rugby game in the sense that you kind of always know when one team is going through its purple patch and is in attack mode.
Yes.
And then, you know, in about 10 or 15 minutes, the other team's going to basically reorient itself towards an attacking mode. So at the moment, and for the last 3 or 4 months, the Russians have been in attack mode. Therefore, the Ukrainians have been in defense mode. And if you look at what the Russians have achieved in the last 4 or 5 months, it's very little. They've lost a lot of technical equipment. They've lost a lot of personnel. And they've made minuscule advances in all the different areas that they've been pushing in. Meanwhile, the Ukrainians have been busy with, you know, their international outreach and trying to train up new recruits on new, more modern equipment. And you can expect the Ukrainians to switch to attack mode towards the end of the spring when the ground hardens. So we're talking about kind of mid to late April.
How useful will the tanks that the Europeans, the Germans, the British, I know the American tanks, I think they're called the Abrams, are very, very heavy, take a lot of shifting and mightn't get there for quite some time. How useful do you think that will be, Johnny, to the Ukrainian cause on the battlefield?
From what I believe, it could be anything from considerably useful to a complete game changer. There's three important metrics that on which you can kind of compare these tanks. One is the distance at which they can at which their cannons fire. So the new tanks, the modern NATO tanks, including the Challenger 2 from the UK, the German Leopard tanks, and the American Abrams tanks, they all generally have about a 5-kilometer range. The top Russian tanks has 3 or 4 kilometer range.
Right.
What that means on the ground is that the Russian tanks will be in range of the foreign tanks before they can even shoot back. So
yes,
that's a huge, significant, advantage. Another one is that the new tanks are equipped with much superior night vision equipment. So therefore, they'll probably start many of their attacks at night, knowing that they've got that superior technical advantage. But also equally as important is that the new NATO tanks are about 20 to 40% heavier than the Russian tanks, because their armor is thicker and made of more modern metal mix.
Yes.
And mostly they can withstand a hit by a Russian tank, while a Russian tank will not withstand a hit from those NATO tanks. So for those reasons, I believe this could be a game changer. Very importantly, that these Ukrainian tank commanders have been trained up in these kind of in mixed battle formations, whereby you have tanks at the head of the battle, you have armored personnel carriers with cannons behind, you also have infantry walking with those with those vehicles. You have helicopters supported by fighter jets in a large battle formation. The Russians have not been able to affect any of those battle formations yet. And importantly, they lost a huge battle, probably the biggest battle, tank battle of the war, in a place called Vuhledar at the end of January. They lost over 130 tanks in that battle. And since then, the Russians have not committed any large battle tanks to the front formation of any of their attacks. Always those battle tanks are just acting like artillery at the back while the infantry goes forward. So they're too scared to risk the kind of battle formations that Ukrainians are now getting trained in by NATO trainers.
Now, you had an interview with a commander of a mobile infantry unit with Ukraine's 63rd Brigade, describing a pretty harrowing battle. You don't use his name for obvious reasons. You give him a name, but for security purposes, you only give his first name, which is Andriy. Tell me his story and the significance of your conversation and what happened, because they encountered the Wagnerites as well.
Well, Andriy is one of the subjects of our documentary. He was part of the counteroffensive to retake Kherson. After that was retaken, he was deployed to Bakhmut. And he told me over the phone in a couple of interviews what happened to him in Bakhmut. He was with his small company of 20 soldiers sent in to support a small trench system that already had another 20 soldiers in it that were, had come under attack by the Russians. And it was something that was pretty standard. He expected it to be something that he had done before, whereby they just increase the amount of counter fire. And the Russians thereafter stop, knowing that they probably don't have the resources to take that trench position. But what he didn't know was that on this particular day, the decision had been made to funnel considerable resources at that particular position. And what he witnessed was the cannon fodder approach of the Wagnerites. So he's in a trench that's probably about 400 meters long, along the side of two fields, and the enemy is on the other side of these are huge fields in this part of the world. Like they're about 1 kilometer wide. Yeah. So the enemy is in trench positions a kilometer away or in the trees a kilometer away, and they're coming at them with automatic arms fire and mortar fire and artillery with artillery support from behind. Mortar fire and artillery support is inaccurate. So when you're in a trench, you're protected from artillery, even if it lands 10 or 15 meters away. Obviously, if it lands right in your position, you're in trouble, but most of them don't. So, but these guys were intent on physically running at them from using their handheld artillery, using their handheld machine guns. And they were able to see how they killed the first wave of attackers. And then a new wave of attackers came almost immediately afterwards, running over the bodies of the people that they just killed. And this was obviously, you know, these men had been just sent to the slaughter. And of course, you know, when you throw so many bodies at a position, you do make some progress. And they did find themselves almost enveloped, and they had to retreat. And the upshot was that out of the 30 or so soldiers that were there, five of the Ukrainians were killed and probably another 10 injured. But their commander made his own estimation that 140 of the Russians had been killed.
Yes, and that's an amazing story, an amazing statistic. And one of the things that Putin is invoking, you point this out in the piece you wrote for the Currency, these are the same tactics from the Second World War that worked in Stalingrad. They're ruthless, they're wasteful, you point out, but Russia has hundreds of thousands of people to call on so that kind of thing can be effective. But that's not a decision being made on the ground. It's a decision being made in Moscow, whereas Ukraine and their generals and their battlefield leaders are making decisions using their own intelligence. Those numbers, five lost as compared to 140, are dramatic. And if you multiply that around the size of this conflict and the areas covered, it's massive.
Yeah, well, I think Putin has made a calculation that this system of fighting can work. He has full control over the media at home, so he can keep a lid on any protests from mothers who may, want to raise the subject of this, you know, in the Russian media. So he knows he can send all these guys to their deaths and not suffer much of a public backlash at home. The question is whether it will be successful in a modern war of the digital age. It was successful in Stalingrad, but Putin seems to be possibly, you know, sinking in the swamp of his own alternative history here, because what worked 50 or 80 years ago may not necessarily work now. So we should find out in the summer what level of what level of progress the Ukrainians can make armed with modern equipment and a modern approach to battlefield dynamics.
Just a final question, Johnny, from your own observations. I know you're making a documentary film on all of this. Looking at it sort of dispassionately, are we looking here at a long conflict, a long war? Or when you mentioned tanks, perhaps, especially the more nimble tanks that the Germans are sending and the Poles, the game changer might kick in earlier. And the other question I'd like to ask you is, can Putin survive a ghastly failure with all of those casualties and his military humiliated?
Well, the first question, whether this will be a long war or not, we just don't know.
Yeah.
But I think if Ukraine can make some significant progress from April until June and demonstrate that their battlefield strategies are working, then you can imagine that it won't be a long war. But if they can't achieve that, then yes, it looks like it could be a long war, because it doesn't seem likely that any treaty or peace agreement or even truce can be agreed on with Putin, anything.
Yes.
that can hold. And
I mean,
of course,
Emmanuel Macron, the French are calling for negotiations, and they're saying that Putin must be part of that. From where you're watching this and observing it and participating in it as a journalist, does that seem likely to you?
No, I don't think negotiate. Right. Well, I think negotiations can just, bring in a truce, a temporary truce. But both sides are going to increase their military positions, within that, any kind of a truce, with the possibility that it could flare up any time again. So I think, look, the war is always going to be there until Putin is gone. And to your second question, can Putin survive a humiliation? I don't think he can survive a humiliation. Right. And I think what could happen, one of the options that could happen, is that the Russian line collapses under the pressure of a well-resourced Ukrainian counteroffensive in the late spring or summer. I just came back from Kherson, which had been retreated from by the Russians in November, and the setting off a very solid front line along a kind of a mile-long river, the Dnipro. But what's happened there is the Ukrainians are already starting to make progress on the east side of that river, and people on the ground have told me that they expect the Russians to retreat even further towards Crimea on the east side of the river, following Ukrainian pressure. And if that breaks, which I predict it may in the next month, that will be another big story, a fourth success, if you like, for the Ukrainians following Kyiv, Kharkiv, and Kherson. So I'm optimistic that the Ukrainians will make the progress that we all hope they will. But it is hard to predict. Yes, Russia has huge reserves of resources and personnel that they can continue to call on. And of course, the big joker card in the whole thing is whether the Chinese will yes. start to support Russia with heavy weaponry.
Right. Okay, Johnny, we're very grateful to you for joining us from Kyiv today. Johnny O'Reilly is a filmmaker and a journalist. He's written a piece for The Currency, which is an online publication and a very good one, with top-class journalists working for them. We're grateful to Johnny, to all of you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.